Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ sanghaṃ namassāmi. So as Sol pointed out, we're still in the rains retreat. We've got about a week and a half to go before we finish. And as I mentioned last time that I was down here, which is during the rains retreat, we don't spend the whole 3 month period in seclusion. It's a time for focusing more intently on our formal practice of meditation and of studying the Buddha's teachings and also of studying the rules of the monastic life, the Vinaya. But we also continue to run the monastery in the usual way. People come to offer dana. We give talks and we have to, of course, look after the monastery. And in fact, this time of year is quite a busy time in the monastery because we're coming into the bushfire season. And because the nuns' monastery is on 583 acres of bush, we have to take our bushfire preparedness quite seriously. And so before the end of the burning period on the 30th of September, we take quite a lot of time and put a lot of effort into doing some burning for ourselves. And then we also have some help from the local volunteer fire brigade. They come in and do some burning as well, which doesn't happen until October. So although we're on rains retreat, we still have a lot of things to attend to. And one of the aspects of living in the bush is that we are very in touch with the rainfall. It's one of the places in the world where the rains retreat in the monastic calendar actually coincides with the rainy season in the in nature, and it makes it very pleasant to be inside meditating during the rainy season. And because we are dependent on the rainfall for our water supply, we take a lot of interest in the rainfall. And this year the rainfall has been particularly good, and last year we put in some new rainwater tanks, some large rainwater storage tanks, and for the first time we've been able to fill all our rainwater tanks. And so we've been very pleased about that. And so one of the things which I mention when people come to the monastery is our connection with the natural environment and our connection with the elements like the rainfall. And for those of you who've come to the monastery, you'll know that we have lots of signs around asking people to be frugal with water, to be careful with water, because we have only a little bit. Well, we have more at the moment, but we still encourage people to be frugal with it. But the other day we had some people in the monastery, some children, and so I was explaining to them about our connection with the natural environment and how we try to respect the environment that we live in, and how important the rainfall is, because we don't have a big pipe coming from somewhere to bring us the water out of our taps. We have to actually catch the water in the gutters on the buildings, and then that water has to go into our little water tanks and then be pumped up to our big water tank. And I said, I'm very happy when I see that the marker on the outside of the tank is going up, up, up. And I said, there's a little buoy sitting inside, a little weight that balances on the water. And when that water rises inside, it makes the marker on the outside go up. And one of the mothers in the group said to her five-year-old, "Sister doesn't mean a little boy like you is sitting inside the tank waiting for the water to go up, up, up." It was one of those moments where I really had to stop and smile, because this little boy was listening in a very interested way to what I was saying. And when I use the word that there's a little boy inside sitting on the water, I didn't of course mean a little human boy, but his knowledge of what that meant, immediately his mother knew, he had pictured that there was a little child about his size sitting in the tank all winter, helping us to judge how much water we'd been able to catch. Now this has made me think about how our perceptions, our assumed knowledge about things, colours, what information we take in and what sense we make of it. And this was a very good illustration of this young fellow's assumed knowledge about what a little boy is, would have coloured his ideas and understanding of what I was talking about in the gauge on the water tank. And it's a very useful illustration of what we mean by our conditioning and how our perception, which is based on our past experience and our known experience or knowledge of life, is not necessarily something that comes out of our greed and hatred. Very often when we talk about how our conditioning affects how we relate to something in the present moment, that word conditioning has a very loaded meaning in people's minds, and they add on to it the idea that it means something bad, that it means something bad about them, that they have that idea or that conditioning, even that karma, vipaka, the result of that, something that they've done because they've done something wrong. But this was a very neutral kind of experience, in the sense that this little chap's understanding and his perception of what this marker was not loaded with any kind of sense of being bad or of an emotion that was out of control. It was simply the result of what he'd been exposed to so far in his life. So I thought it was a very good illustration to help us to see that when we talk about conditioning, and when we talk about the fact that our mind already has a picture of something based on our previous exposure that may not be connected to what we're experiencing in the present. This example is a very good one to remember, so that we can see we're not making a judgment about ourselves as being bad because our perception is incorrect. We're just starting to become consciously aware of the influences that are playing themselves out in our life. To be able to pick up on our perceptions and to start to become aware of our assumed knowledge, what we expect of situations, how we've always looked at it without even realizing that we're looking at it in a particular way. This is what the practice is about. And it's an image which I find very useful, which I've been working with recently, is that this practice is like trying to do a particular kind of puzzle. And it's a puzzle that I like because it has to do with perception. And this is one of those puzzles which you'll find in some of the daily newspapers, where there's a whole jumble of letters and you have to be able to find the words in that puzzle. And some of the words are written backwards. Some of them are written on an angle across the puzzle. Some of the words are written vertically. Some of the words are written horizontally. And you have to look at the puzzle, this jumble of letters, and be able to find the words in the puzzle. And when you first look at the puzzle, it looks as though there's just a whole lot of letters. And you have to look carefully in order to start to pick out the words in there. And sometimes if you know what the subject matter is, say it's about travelling, or it's about fruit, or it's about cooking, you look at it and you might notice one word immediately, because cooking or fruit, that subject matter, already brings into the mind a whole lot of words to do with that particular subject. So if it's travelling, brings into the mind the image of a car or of a plane, holiday. If it's cooking, it brings into the mind words like boiling or cutting. And so because you've been primed by the subject matter, sometimes you just look at it and there you see a word that you're familiar with. So familiarity with the subject matter already produces certain reactions in the mind. And then apart from knowing the subject matter, there's a handy little list of words that you're supposed to be able to find in the puzzle. And it's interesting when you look at that list of words that you're supposed to find in the puzzle. If you look at the list and then you look back at the puzzle, again, a word that you hadn't even seen previously will jump out at you, because you've looked at the list and sometimes you've seen words that you're familiar with, and just that much of a cue will allow you, as you look at the puzzle, to see that word very clearly. It was always there, and you may have found it after some time anyway, but the fact that it's been shown to you as one of the things that you're looking for means that it jumps out at you. And then, as you continue to look, you might be surprised how you just cannot find that damn word. It's in there somewhere. You look and you look and you look this way and that way, and you still can't see it. You have to focus, have to keep focusing, you have to relax, you have to focus again, you have to keep looking, and then there it is. Why didn't I see that? It's been staring out at me, but I just couldn't pick it up, even though you'd had all the clues. So you have to be willing to look back, to persist, to relax, and to look another time. Interestingly enough, the more of these puzzles that you do, the easier they become, because you become used to imagining a word, seeing a word backwards as well as forwards. You start to be able to read words that are on a slant, that are horizontal, that are vertical. You actually train the mind to be able to pick up words which are in a different order to what you're usually used to seeing them. And then it doesn't matter what the subject matter is, even if it's not one that you're familiar with, especially if you've got that handy little list of words that you're supposed to be finding, you'll find that the mind is trained, regardless of whether you're really familiar with the words, to pick them out much more easily. The end of the puzzle, when you've found all the words, there are some letters that are left over. And those letters you're meant to arrange or rearrange so that they say something about that subject matter. So, for example, if it's about cooking, the letters that are left over might say something delicious. And you've got to work out that that's what those letters are spelling out. Now, this puzzle is very much like our practice in the Dharma. Because what we're trying to find in our life, what we're trying to understand, is all there, right in front of our eyes. But we don't know how to look at it. We don't know where to look. We don't know what we're trying to find, what it's pointing to. And this is where the Dharma is like the clues on how to approach this puzzle that we call life. The Buddha's teaching shows us how to look, where to look, what we're supposed to be finding. And when we've found what we're looking for, what that allows us to make out of the puzzle. How to look is what we develop in our meditation practice when we are developing mindfulness with clear comprehension and concentration. In the meditation practice, the mindfulness with clear comprehension is to be able to focus on the breath or the body, and not only focus, but to be awake and aware to what's happening. So when we focus on the breath, we notice not only the breath, but also the mind that's paying attention to the breath. We may, as we start to pick up the breath, not even be able to find the in-breath or the out-breath. And that's nothing to do with the breath. That's to do with the mind that's paying attention to the breath. So our mindfulness at that time and our understanding knows that the breath is there, but the mind isn't steady enough or isn't able to focus narrowly enough to be able to pick up the breath. We apply patience, we persevere, and then, we're able to notice breathing in, breathing out, or maybe just the flow of breathing. And as we can focus and settle our attention on that, on the breath, moment after moment, we notice, again, it's not only the breath, we start to feel a change in the mind that is watching the breath. We're able to relax and stay focused. And the sharper our focus becomes, the more clearly we see the breath, we feel the breath, the sharper our awareness is of the breath. As we are able to stay continuously focusing on the breath, moment after moment, we're developing concentration. Concentration is the ability to stay mindful, moment after moment, on the one object. And as we develop this concentration, we notice that our understanding, our awareness of the breath becomes sharper and sharper. We see it in much more detail. And we start to also recognize that the mind is brightening up. The result of being able to stay focused continuously, developing concentration, is that the mind brightens up. The breath becomes slower but clearer in detail, and the mind becomes sharper. And this is the way that we start to develop the how of looking. The how of looking is not only about focus and clarity, it's about being able to watch in a detached way without putting in the idea of I, me, and mine. So breath becomes simply breath, not I am breathing. The mindfulness becomes mindfulness, awareness, that is observing experience rather than being the experience. So this detachment, this ability to observe in a neutral way, is how, the how of looking. And this is what we are encouraged to develop in our Dharma practice. As much as we're able to develop that in our meditation, we can start to apply that same kind of detached examination, investigation, to the whole of our experience. What are we trying to look at? I said that the Buddha is pointing in how to look at things and what to look at. The place where we pay attention, first of all, is our own mind and body. We can discover the laws of the universe through observing our own mind and body. This is where we do the investigation using the mindfulness that we've developed through our meditation practice. As I said, when we are practicing just watching the breath, we are observing the breath and the effect of calming the mind on the breath, and the effect of being able to watch the breath, the effect that that has on the mind. So this is observing mind and body. But we need to expand that observation to start to observe the body in its normal everyday activities, to notice the effect of mind and body while we're going about our daily activities. When you came to sit here in the hall tonight, I wonder how many of you were actually tuned into the state of your mind and the state of your body, to know whether you were feeling relaxed or uptight, tired or tense, whether you were carrying any particular burdens, emotional burdens, which were being expressed in the body as a pain in the chest or a pain in the neck. These things are available for observation any time of the day, in any situation. We can start to practice tuning in to the state of the mind, tuning in to how the body feels, and starting to see the relationship between the state of the mind and the state of the body, starting to see the interconnections, and also starting to see the effect of the outside world on our internal world. In what sort of situations do we feel relaxed and at ease? In what sort of situations do we start to tense up? This becomes something which we investigate, not in a judgmental, critical way. I shouldn't feel this. I know I shouldn't be like this as a Buddhist. I know I shouldn't have that reaction now that I've been meditating for more than 12 months. Not that kind of judgment. Actually opening up the mind so that it can receive whatever experience is taking place without judging it, just knowing it. As we cultivate the other factors of the path of practice, like keeping precepts, living a virtuous life, the mindfulness with clear comprehension does actually develop, so that as well as knowing what the mood of the mind is and whether it's a good mood or a bad mood, we start to put two and two together and see where that kind of mood takes us if we give into it, if we act on it. What results if we're in a bad mood and we let everyone have it? When we're keeping precepts, when we're cultivating wholesome qualities, we start to not only be mindful of the mood of the mind, we also know the consequences of acting in that mood, and we also start to apply our restraint so that we don't say something nasty just because we're in a bad mood. First of all, because we've committed ourselves to trying to speak in a kind and skillful way, but also because we started to recognize through paying attention, practicing mindfulness with clear comprehension, that when I am in a bad mood, if I say something hurtful to another person, it just makes my bad mood last longer. And we start to recognize, not in a judgmental way, I shouldn't do this, but this is not for my benefit. The kind of judgment that we have comes much more from what is helpful for ourselves, rather than looking on ourselves as somehow bad or wrong because that particular mood has come up in the mind. This is the connection between where we're looking and how we're looking. We're not looking, as I say, to be critical and judgmental, to be uncaring. We're actually looking so that we can be a help to ourselves. So we need to cultivate that detached, non-judgmental approach, which is what mindfulness with clear comprehension has to involve. And then what we're looking at is our own mind and body. If we start to observe our own mind and body, we will start to understand the things which are similar in our own experience to everyone else's. We all have our good days and our bad days. The mind can start out in a bad mood and we meet a friend and our bad mood disappears and our good mood arises. We start to see how changeable the mind is. We start to see it changes because of what it is exposed to. We start to understand, if it's like this for me, it must be like this for others as well. So becoming more familiar with our own experience helps us to understand others as well. So the how to look and the where to look. What are we supposed to be finding in this puzzle? What is it that we're supposed to see when we finally can put the letters together? Well, the Buddha says that the things that we should see eventually, if we keep looking in the right way, in the right place, we should see eventually that everything that comes into being passes away, that nothing stays the same forever. Whether we're talking about my mind or my body or the world around us, the things that I like, the things that I don't like, all of these things come and go. Today I really like this particular food, and tomorrow I couldn't be bothered. Not only do the things out there change, but our attitudes, our ideas, our moods change. This is one of the things that we should eventually start to see. And the next thing that we should eventually start to see is that these changes happen whether I like it or not. Some of them I like when I am in a bad mood and then that mood goes. I like that change. And even though I didn't make that mood go, I'm quite happy to enjoy the change that takes place. But sometimes the changes that take place happen not in the direction that we like. And then we start to see that there is suffering, there is rejection of the experience that we're having. And this is one of the connections the Buddha wants us to make between change that happens in our control or out of our control, in the direction we like or in the direction we don't like. That when we can't accept change, then there's suffering. So it's fundamental for our peace and happiness to understand that change is a part of life. So if it's fundamental, the Buddha says, not only be aware of it when it happens, but start to go looking for it. Be aware of it, even when it's not something really significant. So be aware of the fact that since you came in to this hall this evening, the mind has changed many, many times. Maybe not in just one direction, maybe in multiple directions. Feeling good, feeling bad, feeling good, feeling bad. The body the same. One moment it feels relaxed, next moment that ache is back. Get rid of that ache, it feels comfortable again, next moment another ache is back. Maybe not even the same one. Start to notice these things so that you can understand at a very deep level that this change is happening all the time, moment by moment. Not just in significant ways, but in minute ways, but happening nonetheless. Sometimes according to our wishes, very often just doing what nature does. This is very important so that we understand that whatever we hold to be solid and secure whatever we take to be mine, is only temporarily so. If we can understand this, if we can really come to terms with it, then we have a way of being free of so much of the suffering that we experience in life because things don't stay the way we want them to be. Things don't change in the direction that we want them to change. Things come into our life unasked that we'd rather not have. This teaching on change helps us to accept all of these things, but only if we have been watching and noticing again and again this truth. One of the teachers that we particularly follow here in this tradition, Achan Cha, said that understanding impermanence is the safety valve of the noble ones. It's the safety valve because when we truly understand impermanence, we recognize that everything is uncertain in this life. This body is uncertain, this mind is uncertain. The people that I put my happiness in, the people that I'm close to, the people that I care about, all uncertain. Whether we'll be here tomorrow, all uncertain. Whether what we hope will happen next year, all uncertain. When we really come to terms with that, then we're free of so much suffering. We do what we can. We create the kind of life that we'd like to have. We work to produce happiness in our life. And that happiness is actually supported by understanding that whatever we accomplish is all subject to change. So it makes us very critical in looking to where we put our energy, what we're going to make important in our life, if we truly understand that everything's uncertain, everything will change, then what things are really important to put our effort and energy into. And in this path of practice, we're encouraged to recognize that it's the quality of our own mind, the kind of heart that we have, that's really the most important place for us to put our effort and energy. If we can develop the mind to see these truths like impermanence, then we will not develop attachments to the things which inevitably aren't going to be there when we need them most. One of the experiences of this rains retreat at the monastery is that there's been a lot of death amongst the people who are closely connected with the monastery. Just this week, again, someone close to the monastery died. And so we've been particularly forced to reflect on the certainty of death, the truth of impermanence, because it's come very close to home on a number of occasions. When people are facing their death, and I've had the privilege to be with a number of these people as they've been facing their death, one can see very clearly that the trappings of life, whether it's success, prestige, whether it's material prosperity, whether it's educational qualifications, all of those things don't really offer a refuge at the time of death. There comes a point when even if one has been a jolly good fellow and people are coming around to wish that person well, to tell them how they're going to miss them, what a good person they've been, even if they've been the most successful person, even if they're the person that everyone loves, unless that person has an inner feeling that they are a jolly good person, that they've done the best that they could with the life that they've had, then everyone else's words, however well-meaning, are really empty. Empty of the true impact to change that person's state of being, state of mind at the time of death. And this is why the Buddha encourages us not to look outside ourselves for peace and security. Just as in the puzzle with the trying to find the words amongst the jumble of letters, when you find all the words in the puzzle, there are some letters which are left over. And then you have to use those letters to form the word that's to do with that subject. If it's about cooking, then something delicious might be what you're trying to make out of those leftover letters. And when we're thinking about Dharma practice, if we start to see impermanence and we start to recognize uncertainty in our life, the point of that is not to make us jittery and to make us frightened and miserable. It's to make us, to help us wake up to what's really important in our life. What we're supposed to decipher out of the leftover letters, if you like, is that it's not safe to put one's hopes onto worldly things. These things can add to our comfort. They can help us to live well while we're in this body. But when it comes to the time of death, that's not the thing that's going to allow the mind to be at ease. It's not the thing that's going to allow us to accept our death. It's not the thing that's going to make the mind peaceful, going to allow us to face our death without fear. The thing that we're supposed to get out of deciphering the words in the puzzle is it's most important that we work on cultivating our own heart. And if we do that, then when death does come, we'll be able to accept it, to remain equanimous, and to meet our death free of fear. And not only that, if we cultivate our heart throughout this life, we'll find that we're able to live much more happily. We're able to develop good relationships. We're able to achieve our goals because our mind will be much more at ease with the way things really are. It won't lose energy chasing after things which cause suffering to ourselves and others. And so for the benefit of ourselves in this life, also at the end of this life, it makes sense to cultivate the heart. Now I said in this simile that in the puzzle all the answers are there, but we can't see them. We have to practice to know how to look at the puzzle, to know where to look, and what we're supposed to be looking at. And it's the same with our approach to life. All of these facts of life are actually there for us to see very clearly. We don't really need the Buddha to point out to us that death is inevitable for all of us. But the truth is that we still don't see it. We still turn away from it. It's right there for us to observe, but we still don't want to admit it. We hope that it will be later rather than sooner, that it will be someone else rather than ourselves. And that's why we keep on failing to see the answers that are there right in front of us. And so this is really what the Buddha does for us. He points us in the direction that we need to be looking, and he shows us what we should be looking for, even though we don't like it. And then through the practice of meditation, particularly, he shows us how to look at those things. Just as I started by giving you the story about the little boy who thought that the little boy in the water tank meant a small lad about his size, helping us to see how our perceptions, our assumptions are not necessarily bad, they just happen to be wrong. And so if we can take the idea of bad out of this whole process of trying to change the way we look at things, find the things in there that we really need to see, then that can actually allow us to see much more clearly what the teaching is helping us to become aware of. It will help us to apply the Buddha's teaching rather than to turn away from those parts of it which we don't feel comfortable with. So may all of you continue to cultivate this path. May you find all the answers to the puzzle, and may it lead to your peace and happiness. And may the merit of this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana. We have just a few minutes if anyone has any questions. So the comment is about is it possible to practice as a lay practitioner because there seems to be so much emphasis on letting go, and as a lay person you have marriage, relationships, children, so it can be fearful to think that the path is about letting go of those things. So is it really possible to practice? Is that a summary of your question? Yeah, okay.
My wife's not interested into it. I am very interested in my good business, different textbooks.
Yes, yes. Okay. So this is a very good question, and this is something which is addressed at different in different ways at different stages in the practice. First of all, we have to understand that we're working with the letting go of attachment in our own mind, which is not necessarily the same as letting go of the relationship or the person. We're talking about our attitude to that person or that relationship. And although we have a sense that attachment to, say, a partner necessarily means that I'm attached in a good way and for that person's benefit, one of the things that we are cultivating in this practice is to see that attachment is always has two sides to it. It has the side of being caring and attentive to that thing, often cherishing it, but it also has the side of having expectations of that thing will be the way we want it to be, that it will live up to our expectations and ideas, our standards, that it will give us what we want, that it will be under our control. These are also aspects of attachment. And so when we're practicing, what we're trying to first of all see is the whole range of emotions, attitudes, ideas that go along with attachment. And then we're trying to investigate to see which aspects are helpful in actually making that relationship better and which aspects are actually harmful. So when we start to investigate, we aren't just throwing things away that don't suit us anymore, or throwing things away thinking that this is what the path is about. The whole practice is to help us to investigate, to be more consciously aware, and then to decide which things are helpful and which things aren't. So it's a long journey from starting to investigate and starting to become more consciously aware of the whole range of what attachment means, to coming to the point of actually giving up and renouncing relationships or family or whatever. So I think if you can understand that this is what we're talking about when we're talking about letting go, it's all about our own ideas, attitudes, understandings. That's where we're focusing. And that's why I said in the talk that we need to know where to look. So first of all, we're looking at the attachments as they express themselves in our own mind, in our own attitudes, in our own reactions. That's where we're starting. Yes, that's a very good question. So if everything's uncertain, then how do we develop this consistency in relationships, which is important for trust? So even though it's uncertain, we've still got to live our life until we die, and we have to keep trying to do the best that we can. And so impermanence isn't an excuse for not putting in effort to try to cultivate the heart and to be the best kind of person that we can be. Even though there's uncertainty, what we've got right in front of us is what we deal with, what we put our attention on, even if that's likely to change in the next moment or not be the same in 1 week's time. We build our life on the moment that we have right now and the next moment and the next moment and the next moment. And that's how we develop the consistency, even though there's change happening moment by moment by moment. And so when we realise what's for our benefit and what's for our harm, we continue to put effort into developing those things which are useful and trying to reduce those things in our life which are not useful. And then in the moment, we experience the benefit of it, the payoff for it. And those moments build up and build up. No guarantee that they're going to continue forever, but this moment right now is all that we've got to deal with, and we make that one the best we can. Yes, so the question, if I'm getting it right, is about mystical traditions seem to encourage people not to give too much importance to intellectual concepts in understanding reality, but then how are we going to understand what we're experiencing if we don't use concepts? Is that basic? Yeah. So the simile that's given is the Dharma is like the finger that's pointing towards the moon. It's not the moon, but it's pointing towards it. So we do use concepts. We use what's called conventional terms, conventional reality, to describe situations and experience, understanding that this is just a means for being able to engage in conversation, to be able to speak to each other, to talk around the actualities that these things are pointing to. Buddhism isn't anti-intellect, but one of the things that the Buddha pointed out and which we start to discover is that the intellect and thinking is only one aspect of the mind. Generally speaking, until that's pointed out to us, we assume that thinking is the mind, is all that there is in the mind, and we identify with that thinking as who we are. We think that the thoughts that are in the mind are my thoughts. So we start to investigate the whole process of what gives rise to thinking, and we start to see conditioning in the whole thought process. But apart from that, we also, when we develop mindfulness, we start to recognise that there's an aspect of the mind that we hadn't been aware of, that we haven't acknowledged, that we've underdeveloped so far, which knows experience without conceptuals, without concepts, that simply is bare knowing. And that's, again, something that we can only really grasp and be convinced of if we practice meditation, if we cultivate that quality in the mind. And then we realise that the experiences that we have in meditation, in order to be able to describe them, to pass them on to others, to help us to understand them, we have to use words. We use the intellect to help us to describe them, to express them. But those descriptions are only approximations. We understand again when we realise how subject to conditioning the mind is, that we can be speaking about the same object, even using similar words, but our actual experience of it is peculiar to each one of us. And so, although we don't disparage intellect, we have a more balanced view of it, in that we don't take it as being the complete description or the a way that we can totally understand experience. Intellect certainly has a place, but it only has one part of the place in the Buddhist way of practice. It's past 9 o'clock now, so I think we'll finish there, and I'll pass it over to Sol for the announcement.